You are listening to a digitally remastered class of HaRav Yochanan Zweig, Rosh HaYeshiva of the Talmudic University of Florida.
298. Right, the Torah tells us, 298, sentence 22. I have to give a little context here first, but let's read the sentence. It's talking about you cutting your field. What's the fancy word for cutting? The time of the beginning of the harvest, before harvest, the cutting the field. You begin cutting, reaping the harvest in your land. Do not cut the end of the field. You have to leave over the end of the field. Veleket ketzircha, also things that fell down, you have to leave over a certain amount. Leave it over for the poor people. Things you forgot, forgot to cut, you have to leave over for the poor people. Ani Hashem Elokecha, I'm the Lord your God. This Shabbos, we read in the Torah the section regarding the holidays. In fact, on the second day of Pesach, we read the section. Sukkot, we read it. It goes like this. It starts with Shabbos, then it goes into the cutting of the Omer, then it goes into Shavuos, then it goes into Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot. Those are 60, 80 sentences, maybe more, all about the holidays. Plunk, in the middle of the holidays, is this law. This is literally in the middle of this section. And what is this section? Of holidays, we have this law, that when you cut the field, you have to leave over leket shikhan peyah, for the poor people to take. That's Rashi's question here. It's like, you know, all of a sudden, like in the middle of the whole holiday, Torah starts talking about the laws of usury. It has like nothing to do with the holidays. The middle, smack in the middle of the holidays, the Torah has this law. So let's take a look at Rashi. 22. It's on page 299. It's actually, that's where Rashi starts explaining it. Avardimus, the son of Rabbi Yossi, said, we have it? 299. Why did the Torah see fit in the middle of the discussing the holiday, the festivals, Pesach and Shavuos on one side, preceding it, and after it, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot on the other side? What is this law's smack in the middle of that? To teach you that whoever gives leket shikhan pay, whoever gives the gleanings, the forgettings to a poor person, is considered as if he built the Beis HaMikdash and he brought his offerings inside of it. If you do this, it's like you built the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, the holy temple. You built the temple and you brought sacrifices in it. It's like such an... I mean, the only reason to think it has anything to do with the temple, just on the practical thing, because on the holidays you visited the temple and you brought sacrifices to the temple. Okay, that's in the superficial level. What does it mean? What does it mean? If you do this, it's like you built the temple and you offered your sacrifices on it. The holidays is when we visit Hashem at the temple. And therefore, by putting this smack in the middle of the laws of the temple, it's like you built the temple and offered sacrifices. It is such a strange, awkward message. What does it mean? Number two, leket shikhan pay is not the only form of charity. What do you mean giving money to the poor person? We have all entire chapters in the Torah about giving charity. The Torah really gives a strong admonition for charity. First, you have to give charity, don't withhold charity, an obligation to lend money. In other words, we have greater obligations of charity than this. That's not like you built a temple. This is like you built a temple. Very difficult to understand. I'd like to begin with a Talmudic dictum in Menachos. Tractate Menachos says like this. Echad hamarba ve'echad hamamet. Doesn't make a difference if you give a lot or you give a little, regarding sacrifices. Bilvad shechaven libo l'shamayim. You have to have good heart. You have to do it with the proper intention. Doesn't make a difference. You give a lot or you give a little bit. It's as if you have to have proper intention. So in the Shulchan Aruch, which is our code of law, we have on the commentator printed on the page, the Taz, one of the major commentators of the Shulchan Aruch. He asked the following question. So I don't understand what that means. If the person has good intentions, the person who gives a little and the person who gives a lot, they both have good intentions, so their intentions are equal, then the one who gives more should be doing more. I mean, if you give a little or you give a lot, it doesn't make a difference as long as you have good intentions. If both parties have good intentions, the one who gives a little bit or the one who gives a lot, they both have good intentions, then who should be more? Why should it be? The one who... Yeah, I mean, it means obviously in relationship to what they have. If you give a little or you give a lot, two people have the same amount of money, but it means relation to what they have. So the Torah says they're exactly the same, provided you have good intentions. Now, both people have good intentions, why should they be equal? We both have good intentions, and I gave more than you, or you gave, the one who gives more should be better. It must be talking about, let's say they don't have good intentions. The one who has gives a lot doesn't have good intentions, and the one who gives a little has good intentions. He said, if that means that, then the law is that the one who has good intentions is better than the one that gives a lot. He says, he gives a very difficult answer to that question. But it's a very strong question. If you give a little or a lot, it doesn't make a difference. You're equal, provided you both have good intentions. Well, if you both have good intentions, the one who gives more should be more. And if only the person who gives a little has good intentions, he's better. What does the Talmud mean? I'd like to suggest the following thing. What is good intentions for giving? What does good intentions mean? What is the intention of someone who's giving a sacrifice? What should be his intention? I think his intention has to be, not that I'm giving something, but the intention is, it's yours. Take whatever you want. It's not a feeling of being a giver. It's a feeling of allowing myself to say, ultimately, everything belongs to you. Everything is ultimately yours. I'm not giving you anything. Ultimately, everything is yours. You need more? Take more. You need a little? Take a little. If that's your intention, doesn't make a difference how much you give. I'm not giving anything anyway. All I'm doing is recognizing everything is yours. That's what the Talmud is saying. You have to recognize everything is his. If you recognize everything is his and you bring a sacrifice, which we'll discuss, then it doesn't make a difference what you give. You didn't give anything. If you give a lot or you give a little, you didn't give anything. He took what is his. That's why it's equal. What the Talmud is saying, if you have the proper intention, which is that it's not yours, not you the giver, then it's exactly equal. I didn't give any more than you. It's not mine. It's not yours. I didn't give any more. It's not mine. And you stay, and you gave because it's not yours either. It's not yours. Then the fact that he took more from me is irrelevant. That has nothing to do with me. My intention is that it's not mine. Come back to this way. That's what I think the Talmud is saying. We have many obligations in the Bible, in the Torah, to give charity. We have many presents to the Kohanim, many presents to the poor people, all different levels of this. There's something unique about the gifts here. The leket shiklum pei. Person is reaping his field. He's obligated to leave over certain things. He forgets certain things after he made piles, he has to let it in the field. He drops certain things, he has to leave it over there. What does he do then? What does a person do then? Notice now, it's my field, there's droppings in the field, there's stuff I forgot, and there's the end of the field. What do I, the owner, do?
No longer have ownership over it.
Well, I still have ownership. I'm saying practically, what happens then? How do I fulfill this mitzvah?
You don't take the.
I don't take, and then what happens then?
Yeah,
people those readings. Are you leaving there for people to come and take them?
You leave it there for people. In fact, if you look at the word in the Torah, La'oni la'ger tazo lo'son, you leave them there. All other gifts of charity is where I give it. 10 guys come to my door. I can give A, I can give B. 10 charities come. I can give A, I can give B, I can give whoever I want. Who ultimately has control of the money in charity? The giver has control of the money. The only, and by the way, control is worth a lot. Control is worth, you know, there's ego in control. But a control, but control in halacha is actually considered value. How about if you steal my gifts that I have to give to the Kohen? You've stolen something of value from me because the Kohen likes me and I develop a relationship if I'm the one who gives him the money. So actually it's worth money, control. Control is not only, I'm not talking about the value of the crops you have to give a Kohen. Not this, when it's you and you tithe. I can give it to any Levi that I want. That's worth money. One opinion, Talmud, is Tovus Hano, the ability to direct your money, even though you have to give it away. But if you can direct where to give it, that itself is worth money. I can give where to give. That's control. Here is the one time this is not control. This is giving up ownership. It's not controlling where your money goes. And by the way, it's even a lot deeper feeling. Not only are you giving up your money, what else are you doing here?
You're opening your property.
People start trampling in your field, and you can't keep them out. You know what that feeling is? That feeling is that your house, your property became a public thoroughfare. No, you poor guy, out of here. No, I don't want you to collect. You can't do that. Your house, your property becomes open, and you cannot direct the money at all. It's a very fascinating thing. You can't direct the money. That's the whole idea of giving up. That's not giving. And, you know, most charity, unfortunately, is not giving up money. People are involved in collecting for charities, whether it's federations, whether it's schools, have a very interesting phenomenon. Money usually comes with something called strings attached. We've had sometimes, in fact, recently, a person says, not only do they want, I'm not talking, putting your name on a building is a whole different story. I don't think that's a good message to the community, to your children, what your priorities are. But how many times do people give money and they want to start controlling policies? They want to control who you hire, what your projects are, what your activities, what your priorities in the school are. That comes with, money is very rarely given. I'm talking about big givers. Guy drops you $18, guy drops you $18,000, usually comes, it's unusual people that money doesn't come. Yeah, of course I have a seat on the board, that I'm already deciding what teachers are going to get more money, who's going to be the teacher of my fifth, and I just happen to have a kid in the fifth grade. It's unbelievable. People that are involved, and I don't know if it's in all schools, but in Jewish schools, there's a feeling that the board of directors, the people, somehow the classes that their children are in get a little better funded. They get a little better teacher. They have a little better projects. It's unbelievable. This is the experience, I think, across the board in Jewish schools. Some are just more than the other, but with a school that's run by board of directors, invariably that's what happens. They take responsibility. They fund the institutions. And somehow the fifth grade, where there are three of them have children, it happens to get additional enrichment, new computers. That's the experience across the board.
Well, is it really a loan? Are you really buying a controlling?
You mean, you're right. That's exactly what you're doing. That's what,
I mean, if the tent's there, then you could say, look, I'm
by the way,
money, I'm making
you've been on some of the, am I giving an accurate
that way in this community?
Okay, he's a tzaddik. But they say in other institutions that happen.
About in other places.
Money comes with strings attached. People control their charity. They try to control the charity by the money they give to a charity. When it's a board of directors, that's usually what happens. And by the way, it's also very fascinating that as soon as their kids graduate school, you don't see them anymore. I guess if you give them next year an honorary, you honor them at the dinner for service, they'll be there. 2 years from now, you're not going to see them anymore at dinner. It's about giving money because it comes with strings attached. That's what charity, unfortunately, mostly is. This is charity that doesn't have that possibility. I don't say there's no charitable people, but for the most part, it certainly lends itself to that excess. The only charity in the Torah where has to be without strings attached is this charity. A, you don't even choose what to give almost, except for the payer. But you can't tell, you can't direct it. And not only can't you direct the goods, the grain, you don't even control your property. And people stampede the property, they take anything that they are entitled to. You can stop them from taking stuff that's not theirs, that they're not entitled to, but you cannot direct any of that. No, I'm waiting for my cousin here, the poor guy. I'm waiting for the poor guy who's going to do me a favor. You can't control. So now we have a very interesting. The Torah is now telling us money that is given totally without control, which there's no control, is like you built the temple and you brought a sacrifice. Now we're getting to the why it's limited to the archaic question was, what does it do with this? There's many other places in the Torah where there's more greater obligations of charity. Mm-hmm. So now we have the first premise here. What's unique about the charity here is this is charity that's not giving. This is charity that's giving up. Not only giving up of your money, it's giving up of your home too, of your property too. But now we have two things that's equivalent to. The second thing was sacrifices. I'll come back to building temple. Let's go back to sacrifices. That's what I started with, a very interesting Taz's question. You give a little bit, or you give a lot, it doesn't make a difference, as long as you have the right intention. So his question was, if you give a little bit and you give a lot, and you both have good intentions, then the guy who gives a lot is better than the guy who gives a little. And if the guy who has a little has good intentions, and the guy who gives a lot doesn't have good intentions, the guy who gives a little is better. What does it mean they're both equal? So what did we say? What is the definition of good intentions? It doesn't belong to me. So what is the ultimate gift of a sacrifice? When you give a sacrifice, what's the proper feeling of a person? The world is God's. Therefore, anybody who gives up his money, gives up his territory, is as if he brought a sacrifice. That's clear. Absolutely clear now. I'll just even here introduce a very interesting idea. The Talmud tells us the end of Menachos. We have a number of names for the Almighty in the Torah. One is Hashem, the ineffable name, the four-letter name. And the other is Elohim. By all the sacrifices, the only name that ever appears is the name Hashem. Tell you, that's what the Talmud points out. But I think the insight is to this. Elohim means the Almighty is our king. If he's the king, what are we? Subjects, right? We're subjects. The name Hashem means he's the creator of the universe. He's actually everything. What are we? Part of his creation, right? In which scenario does a human being have rights? In the scenario when we just think of God as king and subjects, or when we think of God as the total owner and creator of the universe?
King and subjects.
Yeah, of course, that's the only thing he has rights. In fact, that's the greatness of the Almighty, that he who is everything actually relates to the world as if we have rights. I was actually talking last night in another part of this parsha, a very fascinating thing. You realize that on Rosh Hashanah, Hashem sits down and judges us. You know, you get a little nervous, judgment. Does an owner have to judge anybody? If I own a slave, do I have to judge him? Do I have to give him his day in court? Does a slave have standing to sue his owner? A slave he's property of the owner. An owner does arbitrarily whatever he wants. The Almighty, who's the owner, does he deal with us that way? He deals with it. You can bring a lawyer. Forget about it. You can sue him. You can defend yourself. He gave you a right to exist, and he can't take it away. He's limited himself with justice. The sense of king means we have rights. If we have rights, then when we give money, whose money are we giving?
Ours.
Our money. in the sacrifices, it does not say God King. Not one time. In the sacrifices, the Talmud says it only says the Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, the name of God, the creator and the owner of the entire universe. Because the idea of a sacrifice, just like God is everything, he gave us rights. Our obligation is to relate to him as if we don't have rights, because we really don't. It's just he conferred them. But God, you know what? I appreciate it, but I'm giving up all my rights back to you. That's what a sacrifice is. A sacrifice is not man's gift to God. A sacrifice is the recognition that everything is ultimately his. Even though it's ultimately his, he deals with us as if we have rights. The sacrifice is doing exactly the reverse to him. Even though we have a right, we deal with what the absolute reality is, that it's ultimately his. In fact, the word sacrifice makes us difficult to understand, the word sacrifice. What does the word sacrifice mean? I've given up something. I've sacrificed, like in baseball, for those who the purists of language. A sacrifice is the person who gives himself up for somebody else, right? That's what a sacrifice is. It's not it. Once you use that, it sounds like we're giving something up. It's not we're giving up something here. It's not ours. It's not ours. It's ultimately, baseball is the American sport.
He's going to keep on coming for the next 50 years. Now that you mentioned
it. I thought you guys don't know about baseball. I don't know about soccer. Huh? It means you have to, you give up. You're not sacrificing because it's not yours. You can't sacrifice. It's the recognition that it's ultimately his. All right, so we've explained what the uniqueness of this charitable gift is and why it relates to sacrifice. What about building the temple? Which is a tremendous... What is our modern-day temple? A synagogue, right? It's a synagogue. It's a synagogue, a place that when you build a synagogue or the community gets together and they decide, many of you I know are involved in building synagogues, is a synagogue a place where it's ours, it's mine, or is a synagogue a place where we're inviting everybody to have a place? The guys who give the money, who fund it, should actually be inviting that everybody should have a place. It's not that they're paying the bills and you are invited to pray in their synagogue. If you have different abilities, maybe you're the person who maybe doesn't have the same resources that they have. You couldn't pay for the land. You couldn't pay for the building. You have to make a certain commitment because, according to what you can afford, but maybe you come there and pray every Shabbos, or you pray every day you help the minyan. Maybe you're a good Baal Tefillah. Maybe you clean up the Kiddush. Maybe you bring the Kiddush. Everybody has something to contribute. The synagogue is not that we have to give up our space. The people that bought, funded the synagogue have a feeling they have to give up their space. It's not ownership that you're invited to pray with us rich fellows who built this magnificent edifice. This is a place where everyone has to feel invited in to become an owner too. Those that built it have to give up their space. Building the temple is not having God come to your house. What it is giving up from our space to the Almighty. That we now have the privilege of being in His house. We're building the house. We're building a house for Him that now we can come in. It's not that we're building, it's our place. Oh gosh, you're welcome to come. We're the owners. I mean, we did fund it, and I'm not saying it came down from the heaven, but the feeling has to be we're giving up our space. Unfortunately, in many shuls, nobody feels they're giving up their space. The first thing anybody tells you is you're sitting on my seat. You guess you're sitting in my seat. It ever happened to you? It's happened to me a number of times the same Shabbos. Next guy comes in like later. You're sitting in my seat. 3-4 times. That happened to me on one Shabbos. At least three. I don't know if it was 4 or 3.
I had worse.
What happened to you?
The usher.
The usher, yeah.
The scene always empty. I'm sitting with my kids in a little corner. And the usher comes and said, you can't sit here. It's empty. Well, I wanted to, you know, at least hear the back.
That's exactly what a synagogue
nobody
is.
Nobody ever said it.
That's exactly what a synagogue is not. It's not that you're buying a place, that you're an owner, even if you funded it, the whole thing. It is a place that everybody is invited to give up their space and invite everybody else in to give their type of contribution, whether it's financial or it's presence, that it's all of our places. We have to learn how to give up our place. Therefore, a person who gives this kind of charity, that he's willing to not be able to control where it goes, allow his property to be invaded by the poor, is as if he built the temple and as if he brought a sacrifice. It's exactly what the Talmud is saying. There's a type of charitable gift which is rare, and it's the only type that actually can create the reality in a person that I'm actually capable of giving up. Most of us have a very difficult ability to give up. You know, you come to a person's home, like by Avram Avinu. The way the Torah describes his inviting guests in, not that he was sitting at the head of the table, you know, getting his place and honor, and these were the people surrounding him while he's passing around the, 50-year-old single malt. V'hu omed aleihem. He acted like a waiter. He acted like a waiter taking care of their needs. As, you know, those great wise Spanish people say, mi casa, su casa. The Bible, the Spanish Bible. Mi casa, su casa. My home is your home. But that's not just to be said. There's a demeanor that really has to create that reality. You have to give up your space. You have to give up your space to your guests. You have to let, by the way, it's very hard. It's a huge difference between entertaining people in your house and making it clear that they're guests, or to actually give up, to actually give up our space. I'd just like to conclude with one thing. As we said in sacrifices, really, we have space. The Almighty created the world and gave us money. It's our money. Ultimately, everything is his. But you know what? He doesn't relate to the world as the owner of the universe. How does he and the master, how does he relate to the world? As the king. Subjects have money. The money of the subjects is not his personal pocket. I mean, a lot of kings, this becomes a difficult line. A lot of kings start thinking that the people's money and his money is one and the same. But a proper king is the people have their money. The king gets a salary, and the country has its needs, but here's their money is their money. Well, that's the way the Almighty deals with us. What is our obligation when we bring a sacrifice? We want the relationship to be what? We deal with it not as we have a rights, which we do, but we deal with it. We have really no rights. He contracted with us. He limited himself and gave us rights. He owns us. No. I do that, but that's not the basis of the way I'm going to relate to you. You have rights. What do we have to do? We have to do the opposite. See, this is really, we have to give up our rights. This is really the basis of all human relationships. I mean, let's start with marriage. You married your wife, and you gave her rights. You gave her...
She was born with rights.
The problem is you. We don't do that.
The Jews have something called the ksuv. You make a legal document that you sign there, you're going to support her, and you're going to treat her nicely, and you're going to give her a certain amount if you even dissolve the marriage. But there's a legal there's a marriage contract, and the Jewish law goes back for thousands of years. According to most opinions, the Torah actually mandates there has to be ketubah. That was food. That's about the right to support food, housing, clothing. That's in the ketubah. Just imagine your wife comes and the end is, you owe it to me. Then go on to court. You owe it to me. Is that the beginning of the marriage rites, or is that the end of the marriage? In a relationship, in a healthy relationship, you never deal with rights. You do exactly the opposite. Even though I have a right, I don't want anything from you because it's my right. I want it because you want to give it to me. And this has to work both ways. Relationships, I want to have it because you want to give it to me. The day the wife says, we signed the contract, that's the day the marriage is over. Even though we do sign a contract, so we should understand what the needs of each party is, anybody who has a right should never want anything because of a right. They should only want because the other person gives, wants to give, which is exactly when we bring a sacrifice, what we're trying to say. I don't want this because you gave me rights. Of course, God, I appreciate you gave me rights. I want this. Everything is yours. You give me what you want. Just like I'm giving you because it's yours, which even though I have a right, I'm giving you because I want to give it to you because I recognize everything is ultimately yours. I want only, you should only give me back what you want, not because you gave me a right. That's the bottom line basis of all, ought to be the bottom line basis of all relationships, all bonding, you know, even partners. How long is a partnership going to last? Partners, how long is the partnership going to last? Because the contract says, I'm going to tell you this, you give me this. A partnership, if they're working together, you know, sometimes, in fact, I think you even told me regarding yours. But in any healthy partnership, sometimes somebody has a greater need one year than the other. And if they work together, you know what, this year you take the extra 20%, and next year when I need it, I'll take it. The book says I'm entitled to it this year. In any healthy relationship, you don't demand what's coming to you. You take it because the other person is happy to give it to you. And the day a partnership is going to be, I want to enforce what's written in the document, is the day you're one step away from court and dissolution of the relationship. That's our relationship with the Almighty. We have to learn how to give up because we don't want from Him either because we have rights. We want because He wants to give it to us. It's a very difficult thing to do. You know, when you have a right and say, I don't want it because it's coming to me. I want it because you want to give it to me. That's a huge, huge giving up. But that's the only way relationships really, really work. It, all relationships only work that way. Healthy, whether it's a partnership. You get 50% and I get 50%. You know, I need more money this year. I understand you need more money. That's your problem. I'm entitled to 50%. Partnership is over.
Is it not possible that the reason for the leanings in the field is that if it wasn't there, the poor people who are hungry and starving would invade the land anyhow and take whatever they want? And this way it sort of legalizes the stealing.
I mean, we could do it differently. We could put an obligation to give money. That's my problem. The Torah puts this, why does the Torah make this different than all other charities? Let the Torah put 20% of your money, or whatever the number this is, comes out to 15%, I want you to put into a public fund. That would have been another way of doing it.
Yeah.
Why did the Torah do it this way? I'm saying, well, the Torah did it this way because the Torah wants to teach us that we have to learn how to give up, not give. When you give money, it strings, it's power. I'm giving them the money. I'm giving those poor people the money. A little beholden, a little respect. This money is coming from me. Poor man, you're getting this from me. The Torah doesn't want us to have that feeling towards other people. Even though all other charities, the Torah wants us to have the feeling that it's ultimately, it's not mine. Take it. That's a whole different feeling. That does the poor person have to be so beholden to you? If a poor person comes into your field and takes the gleanings, is he going to feel beholden to you? He might. But you have no right to demand he be beholden to you. That's what the Torah wants.
Rabbi, couldn't you expand that thought, the relationship of the poor to the rich, to the relationship between grandchildren and grandparents that are very wealthy in today's world? Couldn't you, for a minute, take the same approach to the amount of ties and the amount of
in a way, wouldn't it be more healthy if people took the approach? Or am I? Because I know there. I mean, there's a lot of problems.
Well, I understand.
In legacy, particularly with the amount of money that's.
Okay,
that's
I'm going to tell you one of the problems you can't do this in family relationships, because then why leave to your grandchildren? Leave to my grandchildren. There has to be some special direction to your own grandchildren. Otherwise, give it to
them. But
among which grandchildren?
The amount of tithe.
Ties or time?
Ties.
Money.
Ties. I mean, the feeling.
T-I-T-H, yes.
Money.
T-I-E-S. The amount of conditions.
Ties.
You know, I've sat on some meetings of estate planning, and there are some, you know, some people who are so concerned about the conditions on their, you know,
but it can't be like this. But all money should be given. You should give money, especially to your family, without strings. That's for sure. I mean, I've said them. People have told me before they died that they made wills that are so that the kids are never going to be able to break this. Within the first year, they were already in court. The kids were already in court, fighting with the estate, you know, fighting with their mother over the huge...
Over their deceased mother, or their mother.
And I understood, it took me years to figure out what the real... It's one thing during your lifetime to control. You go to Harvard, you get money. You turn out the way I want, I give you money. But after the father's dead, he still wants to do that. I mean, you understand the huge... What?
Control from the grave.
There's nothing more. I mean, that a person's going to go fight with, just, you know, that's such a terrible. Yeah, of course, I'm not talking about control. We're going here way, but here you can never reach the feeling to the poor can never be to your family. It's not mine, then it's community money. It's community money. I guess that's the way Warren Buffett's kids are going to start feeling. I'm really curious how that's going to turn out.
That's the estate.
Right? He gave $38 billion or $40 billion to Bill Gates, and Nebuchadnezzar's kids are left with $1-2 billion. I'm serious, you know, to me $1 billion, but if there's $40 billion and you're getting only one,
everybody's very, very good.
He's still alive, Warren. I'd like to know how they're going to honor his
billion bucks.
What about the juxtaposition between the two young people? The Rashi. Did you answer that?
Yeah, I'm saying our question was, I was going on the question, why is it in
right between the first two and the last two, and it's right in the middle?
No, I wasn't going on that question. I was, why this charity? But the answer is, as we spoke about last night, that's what all the holidays are. The holidays are celebration. As I spoke last night, holidays are celebrating the Almighty's giving up control over the world. All holidays celebrate the Almighty's giving up control. It's unbelievable. Do you understand what I'm saying? That the law here is, who establishes the Jewish calendar? We do. The Almighty says, I would like to celebrate Pesach on the 14th day or the 15th day of Nisan. The Jewish people decide, yeah, I understand it's the 15th day of the month. You know what? But this year, we're going to start the month 4 days later. You know when the holiday is? 4 days later. Not that they made a mistake. They intentionally feel, you know what? Whatever reason, this year it's important that in establishing the calendar, which is the base of all the holidays, and this week, from this week's parsha, we derive the law that we set the timetable, which means the Almighty is working here. He has a partner. There's a partnership over here. There's certain parameters, but there's a certain amount that he empowered us to decide. Yes, I want a holiday. I want Rosh Hashanah. I want a day of judgment. And that day of judgment, the first day of Tishrei. We want to make the first day of Tishrei 4 days later. We want it 3 days earlier. We can do anything we want as far as that. We're not supposed to. And what I mean is that he told us what it should be. But if you intentionally want it different, Tishrei is 3 days later. Which means the whole idea of the holidays is actually the Almighty relinquishing, giving up his ownership. He's acting with us. He's giving up ownership. And therefore, in the middle of that, of the parsha of the holidays, is he's teaching us how to give up ownership too. We also have what? We have ownership over our property. We have ownership of our money. I want you to learn how to give up too. How do you do? You can't direct where the money goes to. Anybody wants to come in, they can trample your field. They can't damage your property, but they have free egress and ingress into your field, and they take whatever is allotted to them, and you have literally no control. It's all about giving up control. That's why I said the base of all human of man-God relationship is we give up control. Because if we're dealing from a position of control, then we have a business relationship. In other words, I have rights. Whenever I deal with you from my contractual, my rights, then we really only have a business relationship. A love relationship is never dealing with anything from the basis of rights. It's only dealing, what would you like to give me? What would I like to give you? Because I care about you. Now, it's true, you do sign a contract, so there should be certain understandings of what you need and what I need. That's why we sign a contract. Or if we make a 50-50 contract, I'm really telling you I'm going to put 50% of the effort, and you're going to put 50% of the effort. But the day you want 50% of the money because it's your business right, that's the day the business is over. Even in a business. And, hey, I should say it's literally a business. Maybe it could survive, probably not much longer. But in a marriage relationship, it's over. It's over. You're going to divorce court. All relationships are about, not about enforcing rights, but giving up my rights and asking you what you want to give me. I don't want to exercise my rights. That's what sacrifices are. That's what the temple has to be. That's what charity is. And that's what the Almighty is doing here. The Almighty is giving up rights. He was the master of the universe. He comes down to Egypt, and he's actually offering the world a partnership with him. That's really what he wants, a partnership. He's giving up rights. I want you to be my subjects. I don't want to act like the king and the owner and do whatever I want. I want, which means he's giving up rights. The basis of the Almighty's relationship with the world is he's giving up his proprietary rights, and he's dealing with us. He's offering to us to deal as if he's the king, and we're his subjects, which we mean we exercise control. He exercises control. And our goal is to do back to him. Just like he gave up his rights, we should give up the rights that he confers on us, which is the basis of a marriage, too. Let me say one interesting observation. The laws of marriages. Go to the next time you're to chuppah. You'll notice the rabbi gets up and makes a blessing under the chuppah. First, the rabbi makes two blessings, a bori pri ha-gefen and a asher kidushonu, which is a blessing on the fact that they're becoming engaged. This is, I don't get to the halachic status. A few minutes later, there's sheva brachas. And again, we make a bori pri ha-gefen and there's six other blessings that are said. So everybody tries to figure out, this question is like 800 years, why are we making two bori pri ha-gefens? When I drink a glass of wine, and then I drink 10 minutes later a second glass of wine, I don't make another bori pri ha-gefen. So why under the chuppah, if you have 10 minutes between the first and the second? Because the only thing that goes in between that is putting on the ring. Why do you make two different bori pri ha-gefens? No. The bori pri ha-gefen is a blessing on drinking wine. It's nothing to do with, that's not part of the religious ceremony. It's true, different, one is the engagement, one is the actual marriage. That's true. But the bori pri ha-gefen is for drinking the wine. So what do you need to? So they say, from here comes the custom that you read the ksuva. I guess the modern custom, the rabbi talks for a half hour in between. That's considered such an interruption, such a diversion. This, by the way, is the answer in the response of Rashi 800 years ago, and even before Rashi. This is the answer. Almost the only answer to that question is, we interrupt the two ceremonies with reading the ksuva. My question is, okay, you read the ksuva. What is the ksuva? The ksuva is the marriage contract. How could that be an interruption? That's part of what it's, an interruption means you gotta be talking about baseball, not about what you're involved in. That's never called an interruption. It's never called an interruption. You know, if you watch and you say, and you're not allowed to talk before you eat bread, right? You wash your hands, you're not allowed to talk. And we said, please bring me some salt. That's not called an interruption. That's part of what you need for eating bread. Even though if you don't eat salt, it's also, but it makes it nice. Well, it's pretty important that the party should know what they're getting into. So how could that be an interruption? That's what the Rashi, the Mordechai, the Rosh, they all say this answer. But I say the answer is, we're talking into a marriage. What's really the base of marriage? Love. The second you introduce a business aspect to it, that's an interruption. It's too loving relationship. Now, we need a business, but that's an interruption. Don't think that we're now going to now govern this relationship because she has rights. That's not the basis. Now, we have to do that under the chuppah, or we said to say it out so the people should understand what's going on. I mean, the party should understand the parameters. But once it sounds like a business relationship, there's no greater interruption of what's going on. It's going on. These are two people loving each other, decided to get engaged. Then they decided to even take the next step, going under the chuppah. We do it together, but it's, as Solomon said, it's two different things happening. And in the middle of this, you make it now like it's a business deal, like it's a partnership. It's like a partnership agreement, a dissolution agreement. That's right. So therefore, why is it an interruption? Because as soon as you have smells like business, that's an interruption. The basis of a marriage, it's true, there is a business aspect, but it's to be put in the background so both people can know what they can give up. Like it's almost, the whole purpose of doing this so you should know what you can give up. Go have a great Shabbos.